Mr. Navani also has a history of recreational drug use, attending known gay sexual establishments, and who makes his living by writing a violent pornographic comic book. I believe it would take a lot to convince a judge that he has more rights to this baby than Ms. Peterson.
From Slightly Unbalanced, we are still Queer as Folk. I'm Patrick Randall.
And I'm Matt Dominguez.
Today we're talking about episode 2 of season 5, and it's called Bags Are No Different Than People.
It first aired in the U.S. on May 29th, 2005. It was written by Brett Fraser, his 6th of 8 episodes. He also produced 14 episodes of the show and was the story editor for another 14 episodes.
Bags Are No Different Than People was directed by Michael DiCarlo. This is his final episode of the series. He directed the last episode called Back in Business.
Here's the synopsis of Bags Are No Different Than People. A three-way of a different kind happens when Michael, Melanie, and Lindsay collide in a custody hearing with Lindsay's lawyer, destroying Melanie and Michael's character. This results in a judgment of three-way custody of baby JR.
That was a great story. Can't wait to talk about it.
Oh my gosh, yes.
At Carl's urging, Debbie retires from the diner, leaving Rosie O'Donnell in her place. Emmett's queer guy segment on the local news doesn't quite go as planned, but after spreading his legs at the social gym, he relights his gay flame on the next episode of Queer Guy. In a somewhat pointless runner, Brian manages to get people to come back to Babylon.
Like, that's literally all it is. I think it's a great way to describe that runner.
But I thought this was a good episode. Some of the content was ripped off from Bravo, and Brian's story was a little womp. But overall, I like these stories, especially the joint custody hearing. And so I saw that as our A story, the Jenny Rebecca tug-o-war.
Tug-o-war. Love it.
So we start out with Melanie and Lindsay meeting in the rain in the park. And Gus is like sealed into his little stroller, which I thought was kind of cute. So and I started to wonder, I've seen those before. Can the children actually breathe in there? Like when they have all that plastic over like them.
It's not like they're zipped in. It's just a top cover. But that was Gus in there? I thought that was JR in there.
Good question. Yeah, because Gus is too big for a stroller, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, you're right.
Yeah, and the reason I wanted to like specify that because there's this... I feel like Lindsay has a sort of... It almost read like a change of heart with the way she was treating JR in that I thought it was like very easy for her to sort of walk away from the whole situation. Like when Melanie is in the hospital, she's like, cool.
Yeah.
This later. Baby is born. I'm out. And so I felt it was a very weird turn that all of a sudden now it feels like she's absolutely involved in JR's life. Whereas in previous episodes, I felt like she had taken a very easy step back and was very almost objective to the situation.
Melanie's best legal advice is that Lindsay shouldn't have anything to do with the hearing.
But there is one more thing. He thinks it's best if I go to the meeting alone.
And why is that?
It'd be more prudent and less complicated if we kept things between the birth mother and the birth father.
Well, I don't think it's so prudent. I have as much right to be there as you do.
Actually, you don't, and your presence could prove detrimental to my case.
Okay, so in all the times that we have critiqued Melanie's ability to be law... This is the first time where I'm like, yeah, I think she's actually quite onto something here, which is this should be between Melanie and Michael, because I agree it would needlessly complicate the situation even more if Lindsay gets involved, because at this time, at least in 2005, we don't have something like legalized marriage to latch onto. We don't have as clear guidelines when it comes to, I should say clear legal guidelines when it comes to adoption in this way, that to remove someone who is probably the most outside of the situation. Yeah. Stay out of this one to understand that this will help us in the long run. Like, know that, but that of course is not what happens.
I'm still struggling with why Lindsay has such a vested interest in Michael and Melanie's baby. Sure. She's not one of the biological parents, but her attachment to Jenny Rebecca just isn't making sense.
Yeah, exactly. Like it, because I said earlier, like it felt like it was very easy for her to just step away from that situation. Like, she's still definitely going to be Gus's mother because she's the one who carried him. And they have had at least years of raising this child. But yes, she was there at the birth of JR, but hasn't really felt like she was involved in Jenny Rebecca's life.
Yeah, the kid's like up until 2 weeks old. right?
Right.
So maybe if this story would have played out a year down the road and she was more deeply involved in raising JR. But at this point, the only link that's going to remain after she and Melanie split up is Gus. So there's that angle, which is, well, let's have our kids have good siblings. Okay. But I don't know, Michael isn't making a play for custody of Gus. So why is Lindsay making a play for custody of JR?
Yes. Thank you for bringing this up too, because Michael is so concerned about having Jenny Rebecca raised by two parents, but he's cool with Gus possibly being raised by a single mother.
And being passed around. So it sounds like they forgot about Gus. Poor Gus. He's always an afterthought to the show.
Mm-hmm.
So Brian ends up giving Lindsay some advice, and he has a lawyer for Lindsay, and in a snap moment, agrees to pay.
Here.
Who's he?
It's a lawyer friend of mine. I'll give him a call first. Stop worrying about how much it's going to cost.
I guess I have no choice.
Guess not. Well, the queers are about to find out what the breeders have known all along. In a messy divorce, nobody stays clean.
I would have liked to have seen more causality behind why Brian is going to bankroll this. Just last episode, he told Michael not to make it about him and Brian. So what's really his real angle here? Is it just to put one over on Melanie, who has always hated him and kind of gone out of her way to pick on him? Why did he have this sudden change of heart to bankroll Lindsay's custody battle? I'm quite sure where that came from.
I mean, hasn't that always been latched into their clear, much tighter bond? Like, we know that all these casts of characters have bonds that seem to be tighter with one other. Like, they all, as a group, yes, work together. But, you know, we see that Ted and Emmett have something that is a much tighter bond than, say, Ted and Michael might. Here, I think for Brian and Lindsay, their bond seems to be much tighter than Brian would have with anybody else, even Michael, it seems.
Brian is going to end up spending an awful lot of money on this. Right? This is going to be like tens of thousands of dollars for a custody case.
Well, apparently he has tons of disposable income because he's bought a failing club. So why the fuck not?
Yeah. So spread it around to some random custody battle that doesn't directly.
Yes. Let that be the good that he provides to this world. I don't know.
There's a mini runner buried within this story, which is Michael and Debbie's relationship too. I had more or less forgotten that they had a riff. Debbie reiterates that it's about JR, not about Michael.
You need to stock up. Why don't I go to the grocery and...
Better yet, why don't you go stock up Melanie's refrigerator?
Why the hell would I do that?
You told her you agreed with her. You're on her side. My own mother.
What I said was I was not on anyone's side. To think of me like Switzerland.
What, a haven for Nazi gold?
Neutral. All I care about is that kid.
So do I. That's why I want her in a loving home with two parents. Why is that so hard to comprehend?
What's hard to comprehend is how angry you have been at me all these years for being a single mom. And here, I always thought we made it through just fine, you and me. The two musketeers. But apparently not. Well, I'm sorry I couldn't give you everything you wanted. That I gave you everything I could.
The storyline about Debbie being a single mother and Michael wanting JR in a two-parent house could have been explored more, though, because as it is, Michael's just angry about it, but he never was before. In season 2, episode 13, that one was called It's Because I'm Gay, right? Michael meets his drag queen father, played by Gary Beach, rest in peace.
Peace, yes.
And shares a tender moment with Debbie about how he never needed a father and he never needed that two-parent upbringing. He thought he wanted it, but in the end, he was like, I love you, Mom. I don't need a drag queen father.
100%. Like, Michael has turned into such a little shit about this. Like, he's expecting everyone to be on his side and everyone to agree with him. And if they don't or they question his motives, somehow they're all now just 100% against him.
Well, I think it's great that this is happening, though, but I want to know why. I want to know why he feels that way. It's never clear.
Yeah, and it's all. It feels like now he's clearly holding some sort of resentment against Debbie because she was a single mom. I would have thought that it would make more sense that he'd be able to sympathize with Melanie
yeah.
and be like, let me be the one to help you out if this is the case. Like, now that he decided to get gay married in Canada and decided to, on a whim, buy this fixer-upper in a revitalized neighborhood, all of a sudden he's become like the most stringent traditionalist,
right?
And it makes no sense. And I'm like, are the writers just trying to make Michael an easy villain for this particular storyline? Because there's no way I sympathize with him, and like in his efforts to try to take Jenny Rebecca away from Melanie and Lindsay, or even just Melanie. Like, if you take even Lindsay out of the situation, his efforts to yank JR away from Melanie makes zero sense to me. And I'm like, why would I ever want to root for you to claim that you're trying to raise her in a two-parent household?
Yeah, the thing that that kind of occurred to me here is that the Queer as Folk writers don't seem to love their characters the way that Aaron Sorkin loves his characters. His characters are full of faults. They're full of flaws, and they have all kinds of dramatic things happen to them, but he loves those characters and he doesn't do anything out of character to them. Here, I don't feel like the Queer as Folk writing staff has that relationship with these characters, because they have good ideas and good storylines, but they just kind of foist them right onto the characters. And it leaves us as critical viewers going, huh, that's interesting.
Yeah.
But mm-hmm. I'm confused.
Yes, I agree. Like, that is my, I'm glad, like, this is why we do the podcast. This is why we do this show, is because we clearly have a love for these characters. We have a love for these situations they get put in, but we want to be able to understand how those hold up now and why the writers then put these, you know, beloved characters into this kind of situation. And so we're here doing this podcast to be like, we have questions and we would like some answers.
Yeah. And we want to go on a journey with these characters, not just all of a sudden have a character teleport to an entirely different existence. Having mm-hmm. continuity of the character and evolution of the character, I think, is important in storytelling when you're doing 5 years and 83 episodes of a show.
Mm-hmm.
So let's talk about this hearing that happened. This Ooh, scene was great.
Let's.
I wish it had been tipped off earlier, though, when Lindsay was first meeting Brian's lair. I wish that this would have been the gut punch right in the middle of the hearing, but we knew what was coming.
Mr. Gabriel, if I say these things, the things you want me to say, they'll never forgive me. Never.
Well, it's a little late to worry about that. Besides, we're not here to make friends.
But to stoop that low.
That's why you've got yourself a lawyer. So you won't have to.
Why not save it for the big reveal and the big moment? Why brief us in advance about how this meeting is going to go? I didn't like that.
This meeting was, it teetered on the edge of almost being unbelievable.
Oh, I thought it was super
like to not buy. Well, that's the thing. Like, it teetered on the edge of it. And I think maybe that's why then it had really great tension, is because it's like, how far are these attorneys going to go, or how far are our characters going to go to try and win this situation? To have Lindsay's attorney just drag Melanie and Michael the way that they did.
More to the point, Ms. Marcus, on more than one occasion, has endangered the life of her unborn child by refusing to listen to her own doctor's orders, overworking to the point of exhaustion, almost causing a miscarriage.
Is that what you said? That's a goddamn exaggeration.
Mel.
I was fine.
You were not fine.
Which hardly qualifies her as a better mother than Miss Peterson, biological or otherwise. In fact, as biological mother of their first child, I'd say my client, who was more qualified than either Ms. Marcus or Mr. Novotny.
Experience is not a qualification for parenthood. What first-time parent has experience? You learn on the job. The fact remains that your client has no claims, biological or legal.
What she has is a moral claim. It's far more than Mr. Novotny, who, well, let's face it, he's a sperm donor with an overinflated sense of his own contribution.
Hey!
As well as being morally unfit.
What are you implying?
He lives with two HIV-positive men, one of whom is a male prostitute.
Is that what you told him? He's a former prostitute who was abused by his mother.
Mr. Navani also has a history of recreational drug use, attending known gay sexual establishments, and who makes his living by writing a violent pornographic comic book. I believe it would take a lot to convince a judge that he has more rights to this baby than Ms. Peterson.
All their dirty laundry. Loved it.
Wow. And then it's like, okay, to me then, I read this as all three of these characters, Michael, Melanie, and Lindsay, have now completely sold each other out and have resorted to the dirtiest of tactics to try and win JR over. And my immediate emotional reaction, you know, before I turned the analytical mind to it, was, oh, none of you deserve this baby. Y'all are vindictive, horrible people who have no business raising a new child.
Well, the interesting thing is that it's all true, though. It's like Melanie really did endanger the life of the unborn JR. She calls it a goddamn exaggeration, but that's understated. She did not follow doctor's orders at all. And the Michael piece, Michael being morally unfit, there was one ouch moment here. It's like he lives with two HIV positive men. It's like
that. Yes. It's when it got to that he was morally unfit that I was like, okay, Lindsay, that was really low.
Well, there's the other two, though, were accurate, though, where he has a recreational drug habit and yes. He writes a violent pornographic comic book. The two low blows were lives with two HIV positive men and one of whom is a male prostitute. I mean, he's retired.
Yes.
But still.
But Michael tries to defend that and saying that he was an abused. Like there could have been a way to say, no, I took in an abused orphan off of the streets and essentially reformed him.
Yeah.
And he is now he's like back in school. He is doing all like, he's like, that could have been such a selling point for Michael to win this case.
Oh, that's true.
I mean, like I took,
he was approved by social services with Hunter.
Exactly. Like what a way to show off your resume. And yeah. Saying that, no, here's how I have now provided a stable household. I welcomed a homeless youth off of the streets and look at how well adjusted he is now. And now we have a home an even larger home for him to grow in. And like there could have been such a way. Instead, he just went, ow.
Yeah.
Like, listen, you whiny baby, you could have flipped this, or your apparently powerful lesbian attorney could have flipped this so easily.
Oh, well,
and she didn't.
Michael's powerful lesbian attorney had no lines in this scene. She didn't say a word.
I know, right? She's just like.
Remember when she was first hired?
Yes. Like, she had taken on this first case. She was supposed to be like the lawyer.
You know, I don't even think there was camera coverage of her. I don't think we even saw her.
No, there was very little. There was very little.
One thing about Melanie's lawyer, that was her, or is her law firm partner. The one that kicked her off the case a few seasons ago because she was pregnant and she was a lesbian and things like that. So, yeah.
Yes.
That actor was also Holly J's doctor on Degrassi when she had her kidney transplant.
Oh my God. I love how these Canadian shows just have wonderful overlap. It makes me so happy.
Well, here's why I love this scene though. So far, we've only seen Michael as a bit of an antagonist in pursuing custody. It seemed like he was more than willing to dispense with all his friends and those long ass relationships in order to gain custody of JR. But this is the moment when the antagonist becomes a protagonist. And we felt sorry for Michael and we felt sorry for Melanie. And we start to think that the former protagonist of Lindsay is now the antagonist. And I love it when that happens in TV. It's kind of like in Breaking Bad, when Walter White starts out as the protagonist and he ends up being just this monster antagonist. It's a really good storytelling device. And I think Queer as Folk writing staff got this right for the moment.
Yes.
Kind of falls apart later. But.
Yes. But this is also, it's interesting to bring that up because I then started to think like, was this Lindsay's plan all along? Because the outcome of this situation is that all three have custody. Which is, I guess, probably what would be described as the best possible outcome. All three get a piece of this baby. For Hoovo. Yes, but Lindsay has to completely disintegrate the other two people in the room.
Yeah.
Like, her she getting fucked nuclear. By Sam Auerbach was, like, minuscule compared to what she just did or what her attorney did. And now all three have to raise this child, which was kind of gonna be the point in the first place. So, like,
right.
I guess now I'm wondering, like, was this Lindsay's ulterior motive from the very beginning was to have it so all three win in a way?
Yeah, it's unclear. It would have been nice to know that going in, so that all three could have been commiserating over their collective failure in the hearing room. As it is, Michael and Ben go to the bar for drinks, and Michael is just staring at his drink. And I couldn't help but thinking there, like, hun, this is the time to have the drink, not just stare at it. It's like you're so bereft that you can't pick up your alcohol that will soothe you. It's like,
right.
Down that drink. Order another one. Get tore down. Did you find it surprising that Michael was able to figure out on his own that Brian was paying for Lindsay's lawyer?
You hired that lawyer for Lindsay, didn't you? Never mind. It's obvious. How else could she afford him? She can barely afford her apartment.
If Brian wants to pay for Lindsay's lawyer, it's his money and none of our business.
Well said, Professor.
The hell it's not. You're my friend. I thought my best friend.
I am.
Then why are you helping her?
I would have done the same for you.
What you can do for me is stay the hell out of it. Thanks to your unbiased generosity, we're now splitting Jenny Rebecca three ways.
Are these gays having kids? No, I ask you, what's the world coming to? Lindsay's her parent, too. She has as much right to share custody as you and me.
You know, sometimes I swear it's like I don't even know who the fuck he is anymore.
That surprised the hell out of me.
I thought Michael would have totally, like, have seen that coming, though.
From Brian?
Yes. Well, because remember, there was a few episodes ago where he had that confrontation where he was surprised that Brian knew that Lindsay and Melanie were breaking up.
Right.
Because Lindsay told him. And so then Michael's thinking, like, wait a minute, I thought I was your best friend. I thought I mattered more. Like, basically was saying, like, I thought I was the one that mattered most to you. So that, like, for Brian to be the one to pay for Lindsay's attorney when she couldn't, like, when they keep making, like, this reference to how she could barely afford her apartment. Well, clearly he knew that they were breaking up before you did. So why wouldn't he have been the one that possibly, like, helped Lindsay out? Because clearly they have the tightest bond. And, well,
yeah, I don't know. I just thought it was a stretch for Michael to use his brain that way. And speaking of money,
to use his brain, period. Yes.
Speaking of money, why are Melanie and Lindsay always, like, out of cash? She is a practicing lawyer. She's a partner in a law firm, and Lindsay is selling artwork on commission, like expensive artwork. How are they always broke?
Raising two children has apparently wiped their finances, period. To say that, like, especially because they're the only two who I guess are working parents. I guess if you take out Debbie, like, they're the only two. So then therefore they are the ones strapped for cash all the time.
Yeah. I don't know. It just seems like they're never making any money.
Oh, God, no. They're the ones who have to go through, like, the most strife, apparently.
So Melanie and Lindsay have a scene in their house. And what's interesting to me here is that there's no custody battle over Gus. And they're still, like, exchanging Gus. And like you were talking about earlier, Lindsay's lawyer unloads the rack about how Melanie is unfit to parent JR and Michael's unfit to parent JR. So if she's unfit to parent JR, isn't the whole lot of them unfit to parent Gus too? Should Gus be really at Brian's house at this point because he's the only worthy father?
I think they're all unfit to raise children right now. So
maybe Justin can raise the child.
Sometime. You know what? No, let's bring Daphne back in.
Oh, there we go.
Let her raise Gus. I trust her more than anybody.
There's a great closing scene between Melanie and Lindsay as Lindsay is leaving the house.
You surprised me. I had no idea you were such a killer.
I learned from the master.
Melanie always plays it off like she wears the pants in the family, but I think Lindsay's the smarter of the two. Lindsay, or at least the more cunning. or maybe the more emotionally stable.
Yes. Yeah. That moment when she said, I had no idea you were such a killer.
Right.
She says,
it's like, why not?
I learned from the best.
Mm-hmm.
And it's such a Kaiser Soze moment to me. Like, you think Lindsay's like sort of like that sweet but firm one, and you realize no, she's cutthroat. I was like, kind of into that. Good for you, Lindsay.
There's something in this story, another mini runner, that I didn't understand at all, which is Michael and Debbie making up.
Yeah, Ma. Thanks for everything.
I like her. Okay.
Well, I'm surprised to see you here.
I've been coming here all my life. I remember sitting in that booth right over there every day after school. It was my seat. And you'd bring me
a Buttercrunch Sundae.
Well, I did my homework. And all the kids were so jealous. And then when my birthday rolled around, you'd come to class with cupcakes and milkshakes and serve all the kids in your uniform.
And some of your little classmates even gave me tips.
They all thought I was pretty lucky.
I know.
I was pretty lucky.
You didn't feel that way the other day.
I know how hard it was for you, raising me alone. And you did more than make the best of it. You were the best.
What brought about this makeup moment in the diner? Was it Michael being raked over the coals in the hearing? It seemed like he had a moment of revelation that we didn't get to see. All of a sudden, he's bringing Debbie flowers and saying, I'm sorry. It's like, how did he get there?
Yes, at her retirement. Like, I would have thought maybe when she brings the sandwiches over, that was going to be his come to Jesus moment. But even then, he's still very reluctant to say that. I mean, even then, he's still pissed off at Debbie and still doesn't understand the point of view of, you were raised by a single mother and look what happened. You have a husband, you have a home, you have a successful business, you have a successful like creative work. Like, you turned out pretty fucking great. So what is your deal, man?
Yeah, well, I don't know why he just snapped out of it though. All of a sudden
Agreed. Like I thought that moment when she comes over, like that was going to be like why she explains she's on JR's side and that she wants to make sure that the child is taken care of. Just like I did, you know, you would have thought that was going to be the key there. And yeah, it still doesn't happen. But instead, the retirement does it. The retirement party kind of snaps him out of it, I guess.
Which he had earthly reason of knowing was even happening, right? Because
mm-hmm.
he and Debbie weren't even speaking at that point.
Mm-hmm.
We'll be back with more Still Queer as Folk.
First runner of the night is Debbie quitting the diner. Carl complains about Debbie's schedule, so Carl wants Debbie to quit. Couldn't Debbie have just switched to the day shift or shift matched Carl's schedule? We've seen her serve breakfast, lunch, dinner, and midnight snacks, so it seems like she's got some flexibility.
There are times I think she's the only waitress at the Liberty Diner. Right. I thought she just worked 24/7.
Something that occurred to me is why Debbie wasn't cast as the owner of the diner in like season one. Because it seems like that would have been a better way to position her throughout the entire series versus being an employee. It's always unclear like who owns the diner.
I would have loved that. Like somehow like she started working at the Liberty Diner to support Michael as a child. Like here she is a single mom. What does she do? She gets a job. And then there's some sort of as the series begins, she has now become the owner after so many years of being the waiter there. Like that would have been.
Yeah.
Or hell, that would have just been a great storyline as the series progresses. Like she becomes the owner of the Liberty Diner. That would have been great.
Yeah, I don't know.
Maybe for a reboot, Sharon Gless comes back and she's the owner of the Liberty Diner.
What was that old 70s TV show with Vic Tayback? Was it Alice, I think it was called?
Alice, yes, based on Alice Doesn't Live Here Anymore. Yeah.
Didn't she end up buying the diner at some point?
I don't know it that well. So I, yeah,
I don't either. I remember watching
I wasn't alive. So
I started to say that and I realized I was immediately dating myself. So I shut up. Hi, Rosie O'Donnell. Welcome to the show.
Excuse me? That's not good. Yeah, have a seat, hon. I'll get your order in a minute. I'd like to apply for the job. The pull and tear method. In the window. I would only advise doing this. It says inquire within. So I'm inquiring. Probably within. Don't want to watch you do it. Well, in that case, so guys, step into my office.
I gotta say here though, I wasn't really impressed with Rosie's acting in this episode. She just seems kind of stiff to me. What'd you think?
Yeah, I was trying to understand her character's perspective and like a point of view of coming in for this job because she looked so like nervous. I mean, I really felt like sort of like the first time actor not quite knowing her lines kind of situation. Like it felt stage frighty to me.
Mm-hmm.
And then as like her character sort of reveals what she's gone through, I sort of bought it more. But it felt a little jarring to have someone, I mean, this is 2005, so like someone of that stature show up on this show.
And kind of blow their introduction. You know,
it felt distracting. Because it's like, oh, that's Rosie O'Donnell who's like decided, like, they've never really, this show has never really nabbed a guest star like that.
That's true. Yeah. Everybody else has been from Degrassi or Canadian TV. So Debbie teaches Loretta, that's the Rosie O'Donnell character's name, how to be bitchy.
Most of these boys are princes. Once in a while, you get a queen. And when you do, you just got to tell them where to stick a scepter. I don't know if I can do that.
Waitress.
This is a diner, honey. It's kill or be killed.
Waitress! Christ! Somebody gonna wait on me? I have to sit here for 3 days like the lemon bars.
Kill or be killed.
Well, you gonna stand there and pose, you're gonna take my order.
That'll be a milkshake and a bowl of chicken broth.
Why would I want that?
Because the next time you snap your fingers at me, the only way you're gonna be able to suck anything is through a straw.
By George, she's fucking got it.
I thought that the bitchy waitress thing was Debbie's gig, though. I didn't know that all the waitresses did it because Justin didn't do it when he was working there. So why is she teaching the new waitress to be the bitchy one?
One, she's a woman. She's a woman of a certain age. She's a woman of a certain age working in a particular diner in a particular neighborhood and has to show that she can handle herself, because what is she going to deal with when she's doing these overnight shifts? She's going to deal with drunk off their ass, likely very rude, unruly men. So she wants to show, and gay men at that, who are like the cuntiest of them all, she has to see that she can handle herself when possibly having to deal with an unruly crowd. So what do? You stand your ground, you set the law, you show that you are to be respected. And I love how she does it.
Justin never had to do that though, when he was a waiter in the diner.
Well, he could just like blow the people to calm
down.
That's true.
Like, all he had to do was wink and show a little hip.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, exactly. And people would be like, oh, okay.
Yeah.
We'll look at the pretty boy. It's fine. Loretta doesn't have that. Also, Loretta Pie.
What does that mean?
She says that her last name is Pie with a Y.
Right.
So it's P-Y-E. I'm kind of like little on the nose that a diner waitress's name is Pie, but okay.
Oh, why is that?
I just think of Pie.
It sounds like a diner name.
Yeah, it's a diner name, you know? I just thought that I thought it was just like, did you really need to be that kind of cutesy with it? I don't know. But I do love how she handles those customers, which do you think it felt like I didn't buy it? Like, I thought they were just so amped up to be horrible customers for her to handle.
Yeah, I think they were. Like, all of them were.
Yeah, I was like, y'all are not great. But I do love how she handled them.
If that really was to be the case, then I think it would have been better if we saw Debbie teeing up those customers. Like, hey, I got to test out the new woman here. So give her a hard time.
Well, I would have almost preferred that it had been Ted, Emmett, Justin, Brian.
Yeah, good point.
Going like, listen, got a new lady. Try her out. See how she handles y'all. You know, something like that.
Yeah.
And then to watch Loretta then eviscerate them when they thought they were coming at her hard. Like, I don't know. I think that may have been more fun. Because here I was just like, wow, y'all are terrible people. Get the fuck out. You know, waiter, where's my... I was like,
no pink plate for you. Get away from me. Be gone.
Get away from me.
Our second runner of the night is Emmett the Queer Guy. This one was kind of fun. This is the ripoff from Bravo. So let's talk about Emmett's first broadcast. Even though it's a clearly a ripoff, this is kind of a nice comedic diversion in the story. Emmett's stilted straight man broadcast seemed a little implausible to me, though.
Tonight, we introduce the newest member of the Channel 5 news team, offering life from a different perspective, our very own queer guy.
Thanks, Jake. I'm Emmett Honeycutt, your queer guy, here to give you insights and tips on how to make your life more fabulous, better. So guys, I mean men, say you're about to lean in and kiss your girl. You've brushed your teeth, combed your hair, even splashed on your aftershave. But didn't you forget something? That's right, we're talking about those pesky nose hairs. Nothing turns the ladies off more than a jungle coming out of your nostrils.
Emmett doesn't do straight, and he certainly wouldn't have changed his mannerisms as the chief queer guy on the local news. He would have let his flame shine bright. I don't see his reason for turning it down. It was funny, but...
Yeah. Oh, I thought it was so cringy. Like,
that's,
you know,
why
it's
funny.
But like that kind of humor... I personally, it hurts to watch. It just, I'm like, I need to leave the room.
Really?
Kind of thing. Like, I hate, like, it's so hard for me as a viewer to watch someone get embarrassed like that. I'm just like, oh God, please let it be over soon, kind of thing. But what's incredible about that is I agree. Like, when he had, because, you know, he has that great speech when he ends things with Drew, where he says, I've never been in the closet and I'm not going to go into one for anybody.
Unless it's for Channel 7.
And then here he probably, like, that's the thing. Like, the guy that hired him knows who the kind of person Emmett is. Like, that's why he offered him. Granted, I think it's a little token-y to be like, oh yeah, look at this femme fabulous gay guy. He can come be our own queer guy kind of thing. I'm like, ugh.
Look, Emmett, I'm sorry. But after tomorrow, the queer guy's canceled.
Canceled? I only been on once.
That was enough. The audience didn't buy it, and neither did management. Look, we wanted a queer guy. And frankly, you're just not queer enough.
So Emma gets canceled and then goes straight to the social gym, where it had probably the single funniest moment of the entire episode. And that's where he lays down on his back on a yoga mat and spreads his legs wide open. I died.
Excellent. Excellent.
That was great.
I was cackling at his outfit, at his hysteria of being let go. It was excellent.
So his second broadcast is much better, but it took a long time to get Emmett like into the groove of being a professional on-air entertainer. Should have really drew on his background as a porn star and being on camera before, but okay.
Now, Clem, my discerning queer guy eye tells me that you could use some divine intervention. Unfortunately, she's dead. But don't worry, queer guy can help, starting with the hair. A little product. Work it up from the roots. Oh. Very cool. Now, what's with the shmata you're wearing? Fortunately, I always travel with a spare. There you go. That's a helpful little tip for all you hot, sweaty men. Not everyone can carry off cotton candy pink. Yeah. One more thing. The good Lord gave us two eyebrows for a reason. To separate us from the apes. All right. There. Welcome to civilization. Wow, Clem, who knew you'd turn out to be such a hottie? I'm Emmett Honeycutt, and that's your Queer Guy Minute.
Something I was hoping for after Emmett touched up Clem was for Clem to kind of look up into Emmett's eyes with a small glimmer of, like, gay awakening. Like, Emmett awoken something in Clem.
Yeah, right? Because, you know, it was really funny. Before Emmett did his one-minute makeover for Clem, I was like, oh, Clem could kind of get it.
Yeah.
I'm listening.
I don't think Clem had a line, did he? He just said his name.
He said his name was Clem, and yeah, and then he sort of just kind of like reacted to, right, like everything Emmett was telling him. Yeah.
Sometimes, as funny as this was, sometimes episodes are kind of emotionally confusing to jump from like the super gripping stories, like the tension in that hearing room, to these lighthearted camp runners. I don't know, it's just kind of jarring to go from one to the other. And it makes me wonder what the writers think in terms of pacing the episode.
It felt very sitcom-y, this particular runner, especially like when we have that moment in the social gym and when Emmett decides to like, I'm going to let my fab flag fly. And, you know, he does the whole basically reveal of, first of all, I didn't understand the tank top he was wearing over the dress shirt.
Oh, that was a big thing back in the early aughts.
I'm going to go ahead and disagree with that one there.
Granted, you're in middle school.
Well, no, don't get me wrong. I mean, I watched Queer Eye too, and trust and believe, I wore like the T-shirt over the dress shirt kind of thing that I had seen before on the show. But the tank thing was what surprised me. I thought it was a mistake at some point, especially because we have seen Emmett dressed impeccably. Excellently. Like we have gone on and on about how awesome Emmett looks, and here was a bit of a misfire for me. But yeah, I was trying to figure out what we thought about that transformation moment, because here we had Emmett basically doing his version of code switching, where he was like having to, where he was making an effort to butch up his rather feminine personality for television and realizing that wasn't working, and to be told that he's not queer enough, which is a whole other conversation that I think we are continually having in the LGBTQ community about what does it mean to be a gay man. Like, we're all gay or queer in our own way. That doesn't change the fundamental person that we are. Like, I don't have to dress more flamboyantly or less flamboyantly to say that I am a gay man. Like, that is just, it's just who I am.
Well, that's why I asked that question of why this was pegged as Emmett doing that. Because he's not the type that actually tones it down. Rarely seen him tone it down in the past.
I was trying to figure out if it was, because it is confusing, because why, like, just because he is in a newsroom, was that why?
Yeah, it's explained to us that he wanted to fit into the like the manly team, but
it was almost like he wanted to be more professional or something. Like, he wanted to be like a newscaster. Like, you know, like there's that newscaster personality that exists that I was like, is that what he's trying to go for? And so it feels very on, but not very Emmett.
Right.
But then he transforms he goes back to the person. He goes to like who he is fundamentally as a queer person, and it works. But then I wonder the motives of the station, where it's like, we want gay, but what if Emmett wanted to then have like that conversation about like the hardships that a gay person goes through? Like, y'all think this is great that he's doing these 1 minute, you know, it almost feels like a circus act.
Yeah,
he's performing for you, right? But it's also like, but this is who he is. So like, if you see him on the street but not on TV, like, are you going to be the ones that if you hear something homophobic, are you going to say something?
I mean, if anything, the circus act was him not being true to himself while he is on the air the first time.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Still Queer as Folk, stick around. We got a lot more to talk about tonight. Jumpstarting Babylon. I don't know why this arc needed to be in the series, unless it's like another Bravo reality show that they wanted to steal, like Bar Makeover. So Babylon's empty. When this episode started with the S&M floor show, I was thinking, what the fuck am I watching? What is this?
The circus act, as it were, for an audience of three.
Well, it's implausible that Brian could take out a full page ad and out, put window cards out, and have Speedo Boys passing out flyers and draw 10 people, especially because it seems that Babylon doesn't even charge a cover. It's like, you can just show up and check it out, right?
No, they mentioned there's a throwaway line that happens near the end of this runner where they say that, who cares if it's twice as much as Poppers?
I think that's the drinks though, right? Because when people are being waved in, we don't see them paying a cover charge. So I think the S&M show was free. That's kind of my point.
Oh yeah, it was like the act they were going to have that night, right, or something. It was, but also, how is it Brian Kenny, ad man of the year, is doing such a horrible job marketing Babylon? But like but that's my thing, is that he's saying he took out this full page ad, he had flyers in there. The fact that Justin says that this should have caused a line around the block, I'm gonna be like, sure, Jan. And yeah, and we've had this advent of apps, because like the whole point of gay bars was that you could meet people like you to then go home with.
Yeah.
And now we don't need that as much anymore.
I do like the fellowship of gay bars, though. Something fun about it.
Yes.
And there's something fun about not having to like wonder who in the room is ready for some dick. Because most of them are.
Exactly. That is very true.
You there. Come here.
Come hither.
So Justin's bright idea is to have a selective door at Babylon. I think the writers had just watched 54 before writing this episode. So Brian employs a selective door policy and only lets in the hottest guys who get paid $100 each. One thing that didn't make sense, though, is how they got the crowd of people outside in the first place. Because if the bar was dead, what were all those people doing showing up there waiting to get in, only to be denied? Wouldn't that have driven them away? The strategy was good, but this arc of reincarnating Babylon just felt like filler to me. Babylon is back on its feet after this, so Brian's brief struggle to get the club back up and running didn't really add much to the series. All it did was fill out space. I didn't think it needed to be here.
Yeah, it still hasn't been clear to me why he wanted to buy it, why he needed to buy it, why he felt like there's clearly a bunch of bars on Liberty Avenue. Why not rebrand it into something else? Why, I didn't understand, like, if he was going to buy it, why not do something to make it better or change it in some, like,
well, I'm okay with him buying it. I just thought it was stupid that he had to go through this dumb arc of getting people to come back to it. That's the part that I didn't think needed to be there.
Right. No, the part that I always had trouble with is that he didn't do anything to change it or to like reinvent it to make it exciting again. Like, I feel like that's the trouble I'm having.
It's he threw the S&M party.
He wanted the execs. Well, you're going to tell me that they haven't had S&M parties at Babylon?
Yeah, right.
Like, there wasn't anything he did to freshen it up, because then everyone was able to just go to a different bar.
Poppers. Did you notice Ted's costumes every time he's in the bar? I'm digging it. I think he can pull off this urban look that he's going for, or skater look or whatever it is. It's sort of done as comedic
alternative
moments.
Look.
Yeah, it's done kind of comedic. I don't know. I'm kind of okay with it. I think he's pulling it off. I think his hair needed a little bit of toning, but
I need Ted's him to rethink this crisis blonde look.
Oh, I so love it. Hard.
I question it every time I see someone do it. I rarely think it actually works on someone. And like, I've had to stop my own boyfriend to be like, he's like, I kind of want to get blonde hair again. And I'm
no.
Like, listen, I have seen you with it.
Request denied.
Whole conversation before you even think about trying to do something like that again.
There was one funny moment here where Brian is saving Babylon from becoming a Starbucks. And this kind of caps off the story. And he just jokingly asked for a tall vodka latte.
To Babylon. Still here and still queer, even though it would have made a hell of a Starbucks.
I'll have a tall vodka latte, please.
I like that because I remember way back when I was a multi-night a week boys towner, I remember stopping at a Starbucks the next morning and ordering a vodka frappuccino. I was like still like wasted from the night before.
Jesus.
Yeah. I was young. So, tops and bottoms for this episode. What was your top, Matt?
I have a couple. I will definitely say I think that the JR battle that happened, as much as I think all three characters are definitely let their asses hang out in it, to watch them all get dragged like that is kind of exciting to watch. I'm the kind of person that really enjoys when there's like a verbal argument, like when it's well done. I really love watching that. As terrible as that may sound. And I thought that scene was like done really well. Like there was no way for them to truly prepare for the attack that they got. And they were sort of left dumbfounded. So I was very into that.
That was my top two. I thought the custody hearing was really well written and well staged. I liked the lawyer's takedown of Michael and Melanie. And this hearing sets the stage for some really good stories in the next few episodes. So I was a big fan of that story.
Nice.
What was your bottom?
So I would say that my bottom would definitely be, I want to root for Emmett's queer guy, like, transformation, but I think the way that, because one, it's so blatantly ripped off from Queer Eye, and his code switching in it was just so cringy for me to watch. It's definitely a bottom for me. And then my other bottom is just Brian dealing with Babylon again, like, he showing how he's a failure as a marketing person, even though he's supposed to be like the greatest there ever was, and his different tactics to make Babylon come back to life, just not working. But then all of a sudden, oh, look at it. Here's all the bodies again. I just didn't see the point to him.
I think we read this episode the same way, because that was pretty much my bottom too. The runners just didn't run very far. Emmett stutter steps his first appearance as queer guy, then fixes it. Mm-hmm. Brian stutter steps reopening Babylon, and then fixes it. So the runners didn't go very far, and they had all too quick resolutions, which is something that we've talked a lot before, which is we don't like quick resolutions. We don't like to have things resolved in one episode or two episodes. We like to see long arcs where people really have to pay.
Yes, let us build up to something.
This has been episode 3 of season 5. Fags are no different than people. Next time on Still Queer as Folk, Debbie finds she is not missed at the diner because Rosie O'Donnell is just as popular as she was. In another ripped from the headlines story, Hunter's classmates find out that he is HIV positive after an accident in the swimming pool.
Dun, dun, dun. If you like what you heard today, a rating or review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to us would be much appreciated. You can also find us on Twitter and Instagram at StillQueerAF and on Facebook at StillQueerAsFolk.
You can find me on Instagram at Patrick Randall if you want to connect with me directly.
And you can follow me on Instagram and Twitter at Matthew PD.
Thanks for listening. Until next time, I'm Patrick Randall.
And I'm Matt Dominguez.
Still Queer as Folk is a production of Slightly Unbalanced. Matt Dominguez wrote and performed the show with me tonight. New episodes every other week for season 5. Still Queer as Folk was made with love in Chicago.